The business story of the day, by a significant margin in both score and comments, is the phenomenal world analysis of Costco as the anti-Amazon. 422 points, 389 comments. This is one of those pieces that the HN community latches onto because it's doing serious institutional analysis of a company that defies conventional strategic logic.
The core argument of the piece is that Costco has built a business model that is structurally opposed to Amazon's in almost every dimension. Amazon maximizes the number of SKUs, Costco minimizes them. They typically carry fewer than 4,000 items compared to Amazon's hundreds of millions. Amazon captures value through data and advertising. Costco's membership fee is essentially the only profit center. They run their retail operations at near zero margin. Amazon personalizes everything. Costco is deliberately uniform. And yet Costco's revenue has grown at 8 to 10% annually for two decades, and their customer retention rates are among the highest in retail.
What the analysis really gets at is the question of what customers actually want when they think they want infinite choice. The argument is that the abundance of Amazon creates its own cognitive tax, the paradox of choice at industrial scale. Costco removes that tax by curating aggressively. When Costco stocks an olive oil, it's because someone spent real time deciding it was the best olive oil at that price point. You trust the selection rather than having to perform your own selection.
The HN comments were rich with personal testimony from Costco devotees, but also some serious pushback. Several people noted that Costco's model has real exclusions. You need a car to get there. You need storage space for bulk quantities. You need capital to spend $300 in a single shopping trip. It's a middle class and up business that doesn't serve lower income customers well. The anti-Amazon framing is real for the people it works for, but it works for a specific demographic slice.
This is actually a good moment to step back and talk about something that the Costco analysis touches on without naming directly, and that's antitrust law. Specifically, how we think about market power and competition. Because the comparison between Costco and Amazon is implicitly a conversation about what kinds of market dominance we worry about and what kinds we don't.
Say more about that.
So antitrust law in the United States traces back to the Sherman Act of 1890, which prohibits two main things: contracts or conspiracies that restrain trade and monopolization or attempts to monopolize. The important nuance, and this is where a lot of public misunderstanding lives, is that the Sherman Act does not prohibit being a monopoly. It prohibits using monopoly power anti-competitively. The legal standard isn't market share, it's conduct.
So having 70% of a market isn't itself illegal.
Exactly. Courts have consistently held that achieving dominance through superior products, business acumen, or historical accident is legal. What's illegal is using that dominance to exclude competitors through means that aren't related to competing on the merits. Predatory pricing to drive out rivals with the intent to raise prices later. Exclusive dealing arrangements that foreclose markets. Tying products together to leverage dominance in one market into another. Think of it this way. If a grocery store becomes the only store in town because it's better than everyone else, that's fine. If it becomes the only store in town because it paid suppliers to refuse to sell to competitors, that's a Sherman Act problem.
And the reason this matters in the Costco-Amazon comparison is that Amazon has faced serious antitrust scrutiny. The FTC under Lina Khan brought a major case focusing on Amazon's use of its marketplace data to advantage its own private label products, and its pricing policies that effectively required third-party sellers to match Amazon's prices elsewhere. Those are conduct concerns, not size concerns. Costco, by contrast, doesn't run a marketplace. There are no third-party sellers to disadvantage.
Which means Costco's model, however dominant it becomes, is structurally less likely to generate antitrust liability. It's a useful illustration of why market share is the wrong thing to look at. The question is always, how did you get here? And what are you doing with the power you have?
The Factories Are Just Rooms piece from Matt Webb was also a major story today. 253 points, 106 comments. The post is a provocation. As automation and AI become more capable, the physical constraints that define factories, specialized equipment, trained human labor, specific configurations start to dissolve. A factory is ultimately a room where a set of processes occur. If you can reconfigure those processes rapidly enough, the room becomes generic. And if the room becomes generic, the distinction between a factory and a warehouse and a distribution center and a retail space starts to collapse.
The HN discussion was fascinating because it split between people who found this genuinely liberating, the idea of reconfigurable production space, and people who saw the obvious labor implications. If factories are just rooms, the humans inside them are just labor inputs that can be repriced or replaced with similar logic. The abstraction that sounds elegant in a blog post has very concrete effects on very specific people.
And the Odin and Wikipedia story was one of the most meta pieces of the day. A long investigation into how the Odin programming language's Wikipedia page became a site of sustained engagement, farming, and editorial warfare, with various parties trying to shape the public perception of the language through the encyclopedia's own editing processes. The author traced a network of accounts that appeared to coordinate edits in ways that violated Wikipedia's neutrality policies.
This is actually a microcosm of a much larger problem with open knowledge systems. They're vulnerable to organized, low-cost manipulation. Wikipedia's strength, that anyone can edit it, is also its attack surface. And when the target is a programming language rather than a political figure, the manipulation is less likely to be caught quickly because fewer people are watching.
Now, we want to close this segment with what we're calling a genuine what-if-we're-wrong moment. We've been fairly confident throughout today's show about the direction of local LLM inference. The idea that consumer hardware running quantized models is becoming a credible alternative to cloud API access. The HN community's enthusiasm for O'Byrne's guide and the AMD performance numbers seem to confirm this direction. But let's stress test that.
Go ahead. I'll play the skeptic.
The argument for local inference is essentially, hardware is getting cheap, models are getting efficient, and privacy-conscious or cost-sensitive users will shift to running models locally. What would need to be true for this to be wrong? First, you'd need cloud inference to get dramatically cheaper faster than local hardware gets better. And that's not obviously false. The hyperscalers are deploying custom inference chips at scale that a consumer can never match. Google's TPU v6 and Amazon's Trainium 2 have per-token costs that are falling at rates that might outpace consumer hardware improvements.
Second, model capabilities might concentrate at the frontier in ways that make local models permanently second-class citizens. Right now, quantized local models are surprisingly capable, but if the next generation of frontier models requires 10x the parameters to achieve the next capability threshold, the gap between what you can run locally and what you can access via API widens again.
Third, and this is the one I find most interesting, the use cases that people most want from A. I may not be well served by local inference regardless of quality. If you want a model that has access to real-time information, integrates with your cloud services, runs across multiple devices, and responds in seconds on a phone, local inference on a desktop GPU doesn't solve those problems. The convenience argument for cloud APIs is independent of the quality argument.
So what would we watch for as a signal that the local inference thesis is wrong? I'd watch the gap between benchmark scores for local and cloud models over the next 6 months. If frontier cloud models pull ahead in reasoning benchmarks by more than 20 to 30% while local models stay flat, that's a structural gap forming. I'd also watch whether the developer tools ecosystem, the IDEs, the coding assistants, the document processors, standardizes on cloud APIs or starts offering serious local-first alternatives.
If the major developer tools stay cloud-first 2 years from now, the local inference community may remain enthusiastic but niche. If we see serious enterprise tooling ship with local-first options, that's evidence the thesis is holding.